The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next to number 85-1963, Tyler Pipe Industries versus Washington Department of Revenue in a companion case. Proceed whenever you're ready, Mr. Young.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, these appeals come to the Court from two decisions of the State Supreme Court of Washington. They involve 72 appellants, all of whom have paid certain taxes to the State of Washington and are trying to get them back because they believe that the Washington tax statutes are unconstitutional. 71 of the taxpayers were consolidated in the state courts in a case styled National Can Corporation. These 71 appellants challenged the Washington taxes as violating the Commerce Clause on two independent bases. One, that they discriminate against interstate commerce, and two, that they're not fairly apportioned. Either one of these defects would be a sufficient basis to invalidate the taxes. I'll address the discrimination problem, and if by any chance my limited time permits, I'll also touch on the apportionment problem. Having granted divided argument, Tyler's counsel will address the issues that are peculiar to that case, which include two Commerce Clause issues similar to those raised by the National Can appellants and several other issues that aren't involved in the National Can appeal at all. The guts, or perhaps I should say heart of this case, are the taxpayers' activities, the way the Washington taxes are imposed on those activities, and the constitutional problems that they create. A very graphic picture of these heart facts are provided in a chart that was prepared by the State of Washington, the appellee here. And to make the most efficient use of the limited time, I'm going to ask the Court's indulgence in referring with me to the chart that the state prepared. You'll find it in the jurisdictional statement submitted by National Can Corporation, and in particular, it's Appendix K to the jurisdictional statement. So that's on the very last page of the National Can jurisdictional statement, Appendix K. Now, I want to emphasize this was prepared by the state and not by us. It was prepared in a context very much like the one that we're in here. As you may know, the state participated as an amicus in the Armco versus Hardesty case that was before the court a couple of years ago. The state of Washington was trying to help the state of West Virginia defend its taxes, much like these here, against a challenge of unconstitutionality. But this court held, after listening to the arguments that the states raised, that the West Virginia taxes were unconstitutional. And so then the Department of Revenue of Washington had the task of coming back and explaining to the executives of the state and the legislature of the state why this court reached that conclusion with respect to West Virginia's taxes and why Washington's taxes had the same kinds of problems. Now, the state in this chart put the state of Washington at the top in the large rectangle at the top, and it put the state of West Virginia at the bottom. I'd like to start in the other order because I think it makes sense to start with your decision in the Armco case. Okay, how does it depict the taxpayers here? All of the taxpayers in National Can's appeal, like Armco, are manufacturers. They're producing something. Almost all of them are manufacturing. A few of them are doing some extracting. Second thing is that they, like Armco, are selling across state lines. Now, in each case, we're talking about a manufacturer selling. In this chart, the state has chosen to illustrate each activity by one of these small boxes. So you can see ARMCO down at the very bottom of the West Virginia chart, manufacturing and wholesaling. And they're connected with an arrow to indicate that both boxes go together. They're one taxpayer doing these two different activities. Now you'll notice running down the center of that chart is kind of a dashed line. That represents the boundary of the state of West Virginia. And in ARMCO's case there, looking at the very bottom set of boxes, you can see that the manufacturing was going on out of state, the wholesaling was going on in West Virginia, and that arrow is crossing the state line. This court looked at the fact that ARMCO was paying West Virginia's wholesaling tax, and it compared that situation with a like company doing business entirely within West Virginia. And that like company in the state's chart here is the top set of boxes in the West Virginia part of the chart there. You can see that both the manufacturing and wholesaling was going on in West Virginia. No state boundaries crossed. The important thing you can see there is that box for wholesaling, if you're an in-state taxpayer, is not cross-hatched. And the fact that it's not cross-hatched, according to the state's symbolism, means it doesn't get taxed. So the court looked at a tax on the interstate company wholesaling, no tax on the local company wholesaling, and concluded that there was facial discrimination there. I'd like to move now to the top of the chart, because that's what really tells us about Washington's taxes. Up there, you'll see a striking similarity. That shouldn't be very surprising. In Washington's amicus brief to the court in ARMCO, the state represented that its taxes were very similar to those of West Virginia. You'll see at the very top pair of boxes there, local commerce in Washington. Again, two activities, the same company is manufacturing and it's selling. But again, only one of those two activities is taxed. The only difference really between the top of the chart and the bottom of the chart is that Washington has reversed its exemption. So in Washington, it's the selling that gets taxed, the manufacturing is exempt, and in West Virginia it was the opposite. Now I'd invite the court to compare the situation for that local company with our taxpayers who are before you today. About a third of those taxpayers are like Kalama Chemical Company, and it's represented by the middle set of boxes there. It's manufacturing in Washington, ships what it manufactures across state lines, and sells it in other states. As you can see, Washington imposes on that interstate company the manufacturing tax because it has chosen, instead of refraining from interstate commerce, to sell across state lines. Another group of our clients are represented by the bottom set of boxes there. They're in a situation like Xerox Corporation. They do their manufacturing in some other state, ship the goods across state lines into Washington, and sell them there. Now, when we looked at the local company, when any company manufactures in Washington, it incurs a liability for the tax on manufacturing. But if it refrains from engaging in interstate commerce, if it will sell the goods in Washington and pay that Washington tax on the selling activity, that company will get a significant tax benefit, an exemption. It gets a forgiveness of the liability it had already incurred for doing the manufacturing in the state.
Mr. Young.
Yes, Justice Connor.
The companies like Xerox argue that the Washington tax discriminates against them under this scheme.
Yes, Your Honor.
And discourages, or encourages, rather, their manufacturing within the state of Washington and discourages them from manufacturing outside the state of Washington.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, what if Washington simply repealed its manufacturing tax? I mean, presumably that would be an incentive to move to Washington, too, wouldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. I think if Washington...
Is that perfectly all right, though?
Under the discrimination prong of the Commerce Clause, I think that would be perfectly all right for the future, Justice O'Connor. It wouldn't...
Well, it would have the same effect. And you argue that it would have exactly the same effect.
Well, it wouldn't have the same effect, Your Honor, because there would no longer be a benefit to the in-state manufacturers that wasn't given to out-of-state people. It would put them on a level playing field. The in-state people there would only be paying a selling tax, but they wouldn't be getting to carry on an additional...
Well, companies like the Xerox company want us to make out their claim to treat the wholesale tax and the manufacturing tax together and look at it as how it operates as a unit, right?
The companies really don't care which way it's treated as long as
it's
treated consistently.
Well, it seems to me that's the theory, and yet the appellants like the Kalama appellants want us to look at the taxes as separate activities and consider them separately. And I have trouble seeing which way we ought to approach it.
Your Honor, I think from all of these appellants' standpoint, the court could go approach it either way as long as it does so consistently. The situation of Xerox is just like the situation in Maryland versus Louisiana. You there had local people who paid one local tax, who paid one tax that was common to interstate commerce and thereby got a credit against local commerce. The giving of that credit that was not available to interstate commerce precisely because they weren't doing business there was...
Let me try to explain my dilemma a different way. If we look at these as two separate taxes, a tax on manufacturing and a tax on wholesaling, then the tax on the wholesale activity, considered as a separate activity entirely, doesn't appear to either discriminate against or burden interstate commerce. It is simply imposed whenever something is sold in the state of Washington. The one on manufacturing, however, if you look at that as a separate activity and a separate tax, applies to manufacturers who export, in effect.
Yes,
otherwise, it doesn't apply. So you might say that that one was discriminatory, but it's hard for me to see how if you treat the taxes as separate entirely, that you would say the wholesaling tax is discriminatory.
Your Honor, I guess the way I'd put it is that without regard to the exact nature of the benefit, whether it's a forgiveness of a liability for something entirely different than taxes or whatever, if the state gives a benefit of any kind to local commerce that it's not giving to interstate commerce and that's based on some interstate element, it is discrimination. And we really needn't look at what the kind of manufacturing tax is or that kind of thing. It's the fact that there is a benefit.
I presume at least some of your clients wouldn't mind the approach that Justice O'Connor just expressed. You have some clients who are manufacturing in the state and are subject to the state manufacturing tax, don't you?
Justice Scalia, actually none of our clients would mind having all of the taxes viewed together, because if they're viewed together, the apportionment problem is so blatant that I think that some kind of relief would be required for everybody.
How does this case differ from Boston Stock Exchange case? Why can't you say that the state here is simply placing a tax on one of either one of two activities in the state, either manufacturing or sale or wholesale? Either one, we'll tax one or the other. Now, why is that any different from what New York did in the Boston Stock Exchange case?
The New York tax that the state of Washington has urged is similar to this. Was a tax that wasn't before the court. It was a prior tax that ostensibly or nominally had several different possible subjects or incidents of the tax. The court was focusing on a current tax that had a clear rate differential, and in the context of that focus, it didn't see any problem with neutrality. And it may be, in fact, that if you knew lots more about the old tax and how it was imposed, that there wouldn't have been a problem. The case itself just doesn't give us enough information to know that.
But you would say then that as a general rule, if a state wants to tax one of several incidents, that's unlawful?
It does expose interstate commerce to multiple burdens that local commerce isn't exposed to, and if that happens, in fact, it would be unlawful. Yes, Your Honor.
Then why wasn't ARMCO decided the other way? Because ARMCO is that? as essentially the same thing, taxing either the manufacturer or the sale. We're only going to impose one tax.
I suspect the reason that ARMCO wasn't decided that way is that the court focused on the two activities that were claimed to be essentially the same and looked at it and realized that they weren't quite the same, whereas in Boston Stock Exchange, you were looking at all things that were part and parcel of a transfer of stock, and they were quite closely related, would typically occur in one state. The national can situation is seen if we look at the last two sets of boxes on the chart there, and I think it kind of pulls all of this together in that you can see someone who is both manufacturing and selling out of the state, and manufacturing outside the state and selling in. And you see that there that we've got a taxpayer now.
Mr. Young, your time has expired. We'll hear next from you, Mr. O'Brien.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The state of Washington is using the same set of facts to impose a tax both on Tyler Pipe, who's before the Court, and on its independent representative, Ashton Jones, who is not before the Court, and I want to show you how. Tyler Pipe manufactures pipe in Texas. It ships pipe throughout the United States to all the states. It advertises nationally and uses regional shows to do the advertising. It sells through the use of catalogs. Catalogs are distributed to all of its customers. Its customers are plumbing suppliers. That's like a lumber yard, except it's for the plumbing business instead of the lumber business. In the state of Washington, Tyler has an independent representative. All of the orders that Tyler Pipe receives and that are processed in the state of Texas come either from its plumbing supply customers, 45% of them come directly from the customers, or through Ashton Jones, the manufacturer's representative. 55% of them come through Ashton Jones. Ashton Jones has no inventory. It simply has employees who represent out-of-state manufacturers. Tyler Pipe is one of six or seven such out-of-state manufacturers. Ashton Jones has 3.5 employees, if that's what the record shows. Tyler Pipe's share would be about 0.5 person, except that Ashton Jones also represents Tyler Pipe in Idaho, Montana, the western provinces of Canada, and Alaska. So as a practical matter, Ashton Jones has less than 0.5 person available to represent Tyler Pipe in the state of Washington.
Was this a due process argument?
Both, due process and commerce clause.
All the other companies that Ashton Jones represents, it only represents in Washington and not elsewhere as well?
I can't say about the others.
Well, then you can't say that it's any less than 0.5 person, really. You don't really know.
Okay, I agree here. It's in any event, it's not very much. Ashton Jones is paid a commission on all sales by Tyler Pipe into the state of Washington. The testimony in the case is that Tyler Pipe operated through an independent representative because it did not believe it had sufficient business in Washington to justify having an employee in that state. The state of Washington taxes the gross receipts of all sales that go into the state of Washington. It also taxes the commissions that are paid to Ashton Jones. Now, it just doesn't tax them. It taxes them under this same statute, the B&O tax. The state of Washington makes a distinction between independent contractors like Ashton Jones and employees. The state of Washington is using the same set of facts to establish nexus for Ashton Jones to tax the commissions it receives on the Tyler Pipe sales into Washington, as it uses to establish nexus for Tyler Pipe in the state of Washington. Indeed, the state of Washington concedes that absent the Ashton Jones activities, there would be no Tyler Pipe nexus in the state of Washington. Now let me turn for a minute to apportionment. Substantially, all of the activities that are incurred, a large percentage, more than half of the activities that are incurred in the wholesaling activities of Tyler Pipe that are being taxed by the state of Washington occur outside of the state. I have listed on pages 2 to 4 of the reply brief the activities that occur, and only two one and only part of the second occur in Washington, and most of the others occur in Texas. Yet, the state of Washington would tax the wholesaling activities of Tyler Pipe 100% without any apportionment for the activities, commercial activities that take place out of the state.
Well, Mr. O'Brien, a couple of past cases, particularly I think one of the last ones from Washington, the Standard Steel case, we've said that the burden of proof is on the taxpayer to show multiple taxation. The possibility of it in some abstract way isn't enough.
Your Honor, the state of Texas uses gross receipts in its formula for taxing the franchise tax, but the state does not have an independent gross receipts tax, although it is in the process right now. One has been proposed for this congressional enactment. If it's enacted, I presume we no longer will have to pay the state of Washington tax. In any event, most of the activities take place out of the state.
Is one of your grounds here the danger of multiple taxation?
Yes, Your Honor, because...
Where else are you being taxed on these activities besides Washington, and in what manner?
We are being taxed in the state of Texas on these activities because in the state of Texas, the franchise tax is determined by a ratio between the gross receipts in Texas and the gross receipts outside the state of Texas. In fact, Your Honor, I don't believe, and I will concede, that we were not during the taxing period taxed on these sales simply because the controller at that time did not examine these facts.
So there was no multiple taxation in fact.
There was none in fact during the period. Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. One of the elements of the Commerce Clause is that the court will look at the services rendered by the state to determine whether the tax is fairly applied to the taxpayer. In this instance, the state says that it is providing four services. The state says that it is providing police protection, but Tyler Pipe has no employees in the state. The state of Washington says that it is providing fire protection, but Tyler Pipe has no property within the state of Washington. The state of Washington says that it is providing other services of a civilized society, but Tyler Pipe has nobody there to benefit from them. The one benefit which the state of Washington has provided to Tyler Pipe is access to the court, and the Tyler Pipe has used the court on one occasion, and that is to bring this case to avoid an oppressive tax. And have paid for it. Yes, Your Honor, have paid for it dearly. Thank you. Tyler Pipe's products, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Collins.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I want to begin by discussing the issues common to both National Can and Tyler Pipe, discrimination and apportionment, and then I will turn to the issue of nexus, which concerns Tyler Pipe alone. With regard to discrimination, the Commerce Clause provides that a state cannot provide, through its taxes, a direct commercial advantage to local business. On the other hand, the Commerce Clause does not prohibit a state from encouraging intrastate commerce or competing for interstate commerce so long as it does not discriminatorily tax the products or services of other states. And the key is, how do you tell discrimination from fair encouragement? This Court, beginning in Boston Stock Exchange, laid down a bright-line test to distinguish discrimination from fair encouragement, and that test is simply this. A tax discriminates if it affects the direction of commerce, either by erecting a barrier against interstate commerce or by telling an interstate business that's already present in the state that it can reduce its level of taxes in the state if it increases its business activity in that state. On the other hand, a tax does not discriminate if it treats intrastate commerce and local business equally, allowing for tax-neutral decision-making. In the Boston Stock Exchange case, Westinghouse, Maryland v. Louisiana that came after it, all adhere to this principle. And Justice Scalia, with regard to your question, I think Boston Stock Exchange is really a key point. My opponent, Mr. Young, said that the pre-1968 case was not before the court, which is, of course, true. On the other hand, The court went out of its way to contrast the two tax systems, one discriminatory, the later system, and the other neutral system as being not discriminatory, and we think that that's highly significant. In addressing the rest of my remarks on discrimination, I want to just briefly talk about the tax system and then in turn discuss the selling tax and the manufacturing tax. Washington imposes its tax on the privilege of selling in Washington and on the privilege of manufacturing in Washington, and the rate and measure of these taxes are essentially identical.
Are the taxes, though, imposed on different activities? Are they separately taxable activities?
Yes, Justice O'Connor, they are separately taxable activities, but the same business does not pay both taxes on the same product. That's because of the so-called multiple activities exemption, which basically says if you pay a selling tax with regard to a product, you're not liable to pay manufacturing tax on making that product. So in other words, in Washington, you'll always pay one tax on a product, but you won't pay two.
Well, if they are on separate activities, a manufacturer within the state of Washington who then exports the product for sale in another state is taxed.
That's correct.
On the manufacturer.
That's correct.
But a manufacturer in Washington who also sells the product in Washington is excused from paying the manufacturing tax.
If he's paid the selling tax, that's correct.
Why doesn't that amount, in effect, to a tax on exports?
The reason it doesn't...
If you view them as taxes on separate activities, it looks pretty clear.
Well, I don't think that's not correct, Justice O'Connor, and the reason is because the manufacturing tax is a compensating tax, just like the use tax is a compensating tax. The example that you gave me would also apply exactly to a general use tax, primarily imposed on interstate commerce.
You have a decision in the state of Washington in a fiber board case mm-hmm. that makes it look very much like those two taxes are not compensating taxes.
Well, Your Honor, the fiber board case is a situation, of course, which isn't before this court because in that case, a manufacturer partially manufactured in Washington, partially finished the manufacturing out of the state, and then sold the product back in Washington and paid two taxes, both a selling tax and a manufacturing tax. That system would fail our bright line test. And if any of the taxpayers here were doing business in that way, we would lose. But the reason that it's discriminatory is because the multiple activities exemption did not operate. The normal rule in Washington is you only pay one tax with regard to the same product, just as in a sales and use tax situation, you only pay one tax with regard to the same product. If the multiple activities exemption had operated, then you would have had that single tax, and it would have been neutral. I mean, it's a completely different situation.
What does it take to make something a compensating tax? I mean, suppose you get an exemption from the state income tax if you ship it out of state. Or, I'm sorry, which way does it go? If you sell it in state.
Justice Scalia,
would that be a compensating tax? All of my income comes only from this product. So if I'm paying income tax, I'm ultimately paying it because of the sale of this product. Could the state just say, if you sell the product in state, you're exempt from the state income?
No.
Why not?
One of the fights between the parties in this case is over compensating tax criteria. And the criteria that we've urged and is supported by this court's decision is kind of a two-prong criteria. You've got to look at the two taxes you're comparing, an income tax and some other tax, or in this particular case, a selling tax and a manufacturing
sure.
tax, and he asked two questions. Are the taxes designed to achieve equality, and do they actually result in equal treatment of in-state and out-of-state taxpayers similarly situated? Now, with your example, for an income tax has been found to be a compensating-type tax with a corporate franchise tax. Let me give you a citation, Justice Scalia. West Publishing Company versus McGoldrin. It's 166 Pacific 2nd, 561, and it was affirmed in a per curiam decision by this court in 328 U.S. 823. In that case, California had a corporate franchise tax imposed only on local business, and it had an income tax that it was imposed on interstate commerce. And there was a multiple activities exemption that basically said if you pay the corporate franchise tax, you don't have to pay the income tax. And the California court and this court had no difficulty in saying that that was not discriminatory because the burdens were equal in those two taxes. So in this situation, for example, in the case before the court here, Washington's selling and manufacturing taxes are compensating taxes. They're designed to achieve equality because they have the same rate and measure with regard to the same
taxes. That's all it takes. As long as the burdens are the same, they are compensating taxes.
That's right. Now, that's the key to the decision and the key to essentially tax-neutral decision-making. I mean, the reason that a compensating tax works, the engine that drives it, is it passes the bright-line test. That is to say, a compensating tax is neutral with regard to the direction of commerce. In Washington, if you manufacture a product in this state and sell it here, you'll pay selling tax. If you manufacture it in this state and sell it someplace else, you'll pay manufacturing tax. But the amount of those taxes will be the same. So there's no incentive for you to say, I'm going to move my manufacturing operation out of the state and sell into Washington, or I'm going to move my manufacturing operation into the state and sell in Washington. Oh. Your bottom line taxes will be
there,
the same.
There is an incentive to you, isn't there, to sell in Washington rather than sell outside of Washington?
No, I don't think so, Justice Scalia. Well, if you manufacture a product worth $1,000 in Washington and sell it in another state, mm-hmm. you'll pay $4.40 of manufacturing tax. If you manufacture it in Washington and sell it in Washington, you'll pay $4.40 of selling tax.
You're assuming quite unrealistically that there's no sales tax anywhere else, that there's no tax on your selling activity elsewhere, as there is in Washington.
Two things about that.
Assume the state you're selling into has the same law that Washington has. If you sell interstate, you'll pay both a manufacturing tax and a selling tax. If you sell within your own state, you'll pay only the selling tax.
That's right.
Right? So doesn't that discriminate against interstate commerce?
Well, I don't think it does, Justice Scalia. But that's a question that this court has yet to resolve, and it goes back to the court's decision in Southern Pacific versus Gallagher.
Well, it hasn't resolved it unless it resolved it in the Armco case.
Well,
isn't that just exactly what that case involved on each other side of the coin?
Well, I don't think that's accurate, Justice Stevens, and the reason why is because. In Armco, this court,
taxes were differing amounts.
This court ruled that the manufacturing tax and the wholesaling tax weren't compensating taxes because they didn't pass the criteria. They were not proxies for one another because of differences in the rate and differences in the measure. And the
Mr.
court,
Collins, isn't the I don't know where this Exhibit K came from that your opponent's entire argument was based on that, but if that's a valid portrayal of what would happen if Oregon had precisely the same scheme that Washington had, and that's the out-of-state system here. Why isn't it blatant discrimination?
Well, Your Honor, Exhibit K also perfectly describes the situation in Southern Pacific versus Gallagher. Because in that case, bought a product in another state, used it in California, you would pay, hypothetically, two taxes, a selling tax in the other state and a use tax in California. Well, a local person buying.
What you're saying is if we follow these cases, we have to overrule that case. Is that what you're saying?
Well,
why? How do you distinguish the Armco in this case? I mean, you distinguish on the amounts, but assuming, do you think West Virginia could cure its problem and look at the diagrams and just say, impose only a manufacturing tax, impose a manufacturing tax only when they sell out of state and impose a manufacturing tax, excuse him from paying the manufacturing tax when you sell in state?
But it's not the direction.
I'm sorry, it's the other way around. You get excused from the wholesale tax there.
It's not the direction that determines whether it's constitutional or not. It's not that we give our exemption for manufacturers who sell in the state. That's not what drives it. West Virginia could cure their problem if they did two things. One, if the rates of the selling and the manufacturing taxes were the same, and two, if the measures of the tax were the same, because it was those things that the court looked at.
Well, I suppose that's the issue here, because here we have it. But I didn't. I know you cited a case to me, but why is it not true that if Oregon had the same scheme that you have, and you have just the same tax, both have these taxes, why is it not true that the local commerce is taxed less heavily than the interstate commerce? It is. It's perfectly clear it is taxed less heavily, isn't it?
This court has never taken into account
the taxes. Well, just asking you, if maybe we should. But I know there's
one. They would pay more taxes.
Pardon me?
They would pay more taxes.
And they pay more taxes on the interstate transactions than they would pay on the intrastate transactions.
That's correct. But, Justice Stevens, that would be true in any event if you have different states that have different taxes. For example, at the end of the Armco opinion, the court stated that there would be no difficulty if Ohio had a manufacturing tax and West Virginia had a selling tax. Clearly, that would be doubling up. And at the same time, an interstate business, an intrastate business that just did one thing would only pay one tax. And that's why Southern Pacific versus Gallagher is really a key case. Because in Southern Pacific versus Gallagher, the court was faced with exactly the same situation. The possibility of no doubling up in-state, sales and use tax, and a possibility of doubling up out-of-state if a tax had been paid in the other state. And the taxpayer said, well, there's a possibility that we could be doubled up in this other state. Give us some relief. And what the court said is...
Yes, but the difference in your hypothetical is that if both states adopted the taxing scheme of the other, they would pay double taxes in both states. So there would be no discrimination between interstate and intrastate taxation.
But the court, no. The court refused, though, in that case, to speculate about what another state would do. And that's really, I think, a correct decision, and one that would be appropriate even if it was a question of first impression. The reason for that is simply this. In California, in Southern Pacific, and in this case, the state of Washington relieves a business from a tax, manufacturing tax, only if a selling tax is paid. Those are the only circumstances in which we do it, only if a selling tax is paid. The taxpayers in Southern Pacific versus Gallagher, and in this case, say, we want to be relieved from Washington's tax, even though we don't pay a tax to Washington, and we don't pay a tax anyplace else either. The taxpayers here are not asking for equality. What they're really asking for is a preference.
When you say only if a selling tax is paid, I suppose that's the equivalent of saying only if the sales are made within the state.
If the sales are made within the state.
They're functional equivalent.
Sure. Yeah. That's right. And it passes, compensating taxes like that passes the bright line test. What's really, the question that's really open is this. Compensating taxes are justified because they pass the bright line test. Local commerce and interstate commerce within the state are treated equally. And the question left open in Southern Pacific versus Gallagher is simply whether that equality has got to extend to the interstate taxpayer. In the words of Silas Mason, the dweller, the stranger from beyond the gates and the dweller within the gates. In Southern Pacific versus Gallagher, the question left open is whether your compensating tax has not only got to ensure one tax, equal tax within the state, but whether that credit has got to go into the interstate area. And I think if the court was correct in deciding not to address that question until a taxpayer came in who'd actually paid that second tax, because one of two things would happen if you don't wait. A, you'll say you need to extend the benefit, but the taxpayer wouldn't receive any benefit. For example, these taxpayers don't pay a manufacturing tax or a selling tax to another state, so essentially it would be doing a useless act. Or B, they would be getting a preference. That is, local business would have to pay one selling or manufacturing tax to escape a tax, but interstate commerce would have to pay no selling tax to escape the manufacturing tax.
There certainly is language in ARMCO that indicates the court was making some assumptions and not waiting for actual experience. Uh-huh. Isn't that true?
Well, I don't think that that's what the language in ARMCO really says, Justice O'Connor. We're kind of talking about this internal consistency point, I think, is how the taxpayers have discussed it in their brief and kind of what the court mentioned in ARMCO. And really, that point, I think, when you read the language, was simply in response to West Virginia's allegation that even though interstate commerce pays a selling tax and it's not a compensating tax, that the taxpayer should somehow be required to prove that they'd actually been injured, even though that tax was facially discriminatory. And the court said, no, that's not the test, and talked about the internal consistency concept, but related to situations where there is facial discrimination.
Well, if you view the manufacturing tax in Washington as not a compensating tax, it also is facially discriminatory.
No question about it. No question about it. But as I've indicated, if you follow the court's criteria, and I think virtually all of its compensating tax decisions, you will find that the criteria is equality, which was not present in the West Virginia tax in Armco and is present in this case. The bottom line is there's a bright line test that this court has established for discrimination. The selling tax passes it because everybody pays the selling tax. Local manufacturers, interstate manufacturers, they pay precisely the same tax. The manufacturing tax passes the bright line test because it's a compensating tax, like a use tax. It passes the test because interstate commerce and intrastate and local commerce are treated the same and there's no discrimination. And the taxpayers in this case have not shown that they pay another tax someplace else. What they really want is a preference. I'd like to turn now to the apportionment point.
May I just ask one question?
Yes.
Supposing they did prove that Oregon had the same kind of tax statutes that you have.
That's
a different case?
Well, it's a different case because if the court said that something was required, they would certainly be entitled to relief. And if you're asking me whether I think that the court would ultimately say you've got to extend the credit in the...
Or put it another way, assuming we agreed with your argument up to that point, mm-hmm. say the statute's fine today, and then tomorrow Oregon passed such a statute, would that make your statute unconstitutional?
Well, I don't think it would make our statute. Just the act of having the tax doesn't make the statute unconstitutional, but then the question would be directly put, must a compensating tax extend equality to interstate commerce that it extends to intrastate commerce?
What do you think the answer is to that?
Well,
I'm just wondering if the fate of your tax depends on what happens in the Oregon.
No, it doesn't depend on it, but that would then, the taxpayer would really be in a position to raise that question. And as
Oregon and Washington would be in the same boat, wouldn't they?
Yes, that's correct. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just curious about which boat it is.
With regard to the apportionment question, there's no multiple tax that's been established in this case. And the court, in a number of decisions, has indicated that a tax like Washington's tax is fairly apportioned. Remember, our tax is imposed on the privilege of selling within Washington State, and it's also imposed on the privilege of manufacturing within Washington State. And the selling tax is measured by the gross proceeds of sales, and the manufacturing tax is measured by the value of the products.
Is the manufacturing tax seems to be a curious one that's almost a form of substitute for income tax. It seems to be imposed at every level of activity during the course of manufacturing. Every separate part of that process is taxed, is it not?
Well, it would just be taxed once on the final finished product that was subject to the tax. We don't tax it in all the little steps. The only reason here...
Tax the little steps if part of it were done out of state.
Are you talking about the fiberboard situation?
I'm talking about
again?
Your manufacturing tax in the state of Washington.
Well, if you manufacture something in the state of Washington and then it goes outside the state, partially manufactured, the tax is imposed on the value of that product. If it's completed within the state, it's imposed on the value of that product. And the problem in the fiberboard case was that when our court ruled that when it came back in the state, the multiple activities exemption didn't operate because the product was not the product so sold. For apportionment purposes, though, this court ruled that if you've got if the incidence of the tax is local and the measure is reasonable, that the tax is fairly apportioned. Standard Press Steel, the court ruled that the tax at issue in this case was apportioned exactly to the activities taxed. And in American Manufacturing versus St. Louis, the court reached the same conclusion with regard to a manufacturing tax. Now, the taxpayers have argued in their brief and alluded to here that our tax must be malapportioned because we consider the tax together for compensating tax purposes, but we separate them for purposes of our apportionment analysis. And I submit to you that those are two different things. For example, sales and use taxes are considered together to be compensating taxes. But for apportionment purposes, there's never been any suggestion from this court or any other court that I'm aware of that has said a retail sales tax must be apportioned on the basis of three factors or any other number of factors. The point is, those decisions of this court sustaining the manufacturing and selling taxes fairly apportioned are correct, and the taxpayer in this case has done nothing to advance the burden of showing that the taxes aren't correctly apportioned. The only thing they've done is said, well, there's a possibility of overlap with some other tax. And in the court's decisions in Mormon, Container, and even Armco, the possibility of some overlap does not render a tax malapportioned. Let me turn briefly to the nexus question raised by Tyler Pipe. Well, yes, Tyler Pipe basically argued, National Can agrees that there is enough nexus under the Due Process and Commerce Clause to impose our tax upon them. Tyler Pipe contests the nexus. Now, Tyler Pipe sells products in Washington through the use of independent contractors who act as their sales representatives. And there's really two questions. Do the activities of the sales representatives give rise to nexus without regard to what their status is? And the second question is, if those representatives do enough to give rise to nexus, does it make any difference that they're independent contractors? The lower court found that the activities were enough, and this court has ruled in decisions such as Scripto versus Carson that the contractual tagging of a sales representative doesn't have any constitutional significance. Now, counsel's argument with regard to nexus really broke down to this. He said, our local sales representatives pay a tax, and Tyler Pipe pays a tax, and that somehow means that we can't tax both of those. And I want to sort out any confusion in your mind. Ash and Jones pays tax under the service classification. They're providing a service business of representing Tyler Pipe. Tyler Pipe pays tax on its activity of making sales in the state of Washington. The fact that both Ash and Jones and Tyler Pipe pay tax is irrelevant. Clearly, this court would not have a rule that said that we could not impose this tax because of the independent contractor nexus, and yet if we went back to our state and repealed the tax on the independent contractors, that suddenly there would be enough nexus to tax them. The purpose of the nexus requirement is to get a connection between the taxpayer and the state. Trial court in this case found that the activities of the representatives are significantly associated with the taxpayer's ability to establish and maintain the market. Taxpayer does three kinds of things. First, they solicit sales. Secondly, they gather virtually all of the market information from Washington State that's used by Tyler Pipe. And finally, they engage in various market maintenance kinds of activities. For example, they make secondary calls on architects and engineers, trying to get them to specify Tyler Pipe products in their engineering specifications. They're available to help when there are shortages in the shipments or there's breakage. They're the first line evaluators of credit. They perform significant activities. Now, I don't think there's really any dispute, perhaps a bit of quibbling, about the fact that these activities are performed. What Tyler Pipe argues is, we do a lot of stuff in Texas, too. But that's not what's relevant for nexus. The fact that they do some activities in Texas. What's relevant is the activities that they do in Washington. And the trial court found, and it is supported by substantial evidence, that they engage in these three kinds of activities. Under your decision in Northwest Portland Cement, simply solicitation would be enough to impose the tax. Under the decision in Standard Press Steel, the market maintenance activities and the information gathering activities would be sufficient to support the tax. In this case, we have both. No question that the activities of these representatives give rise to nexus. And as I've said before, there's no constitutional significance to the fact that they are independent contractors as opposed to employees. They penetrate the market in exactly the same way, and what the court needs to focus on are the activities. I think that's the learning of the Scripto case. There's one last point I want to make before I take my seat, and that is to rule in favor of the taxpayers in this case, it'll be necessary for this court to overrule some of its prior decisions, in our judgment. And if the court does that, we would urge it to make its decision prospective. In that case, the state would meet the three criteria for prospective application in a civil case set out in the Chevron Oil decision. And, of course, this matter is very significant to the state. 1980 through 1984, the state estimates that it's worth about $423 million, which is about 10% of our annual budget. And, of course, three additional years have gone by since then. However, I hope it will not be necessary to reach a prospective application issue, because taxes in this case are constitutional under the decisions of this court. Manufacturing and selling taxes pass the bright line test. Everybody pays the selling tax. Manufacturing tax is a valid compensating tax because it meets the criteria of equality. In-state and out-of-state taxpayers are treated in the same fashion. The tax is fairly apportioned under your decisions, and there is sufficient nexus to impose the tax on Tyler Pipe. Accordingly, we would request that this court affirm the Washington Supreme Court in both causes.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Mr. O'Brien, you have 8 minutes left.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, you asked about the activities, whether the Tyler Pipe was taxed on his gross receipts, and I said no, and that is correct, they are not. However, we had viewed and do view the law of this court that we do not have to establish that a tax is in fact paid in another state. And I refer to the Adams Manufacturing case and then specifically the Gwen White case, which involved the state of Washington tax, where this court said unlawfulness of the burden depends upon its nature measured in terms of its capacity to obstruct interstate commerce and not on the contingency that some other state may first have subjected the commerce to a like burden. And that was an apportionment case in which this court held that the tax on Gwen White, who would have been equivalent to Ash and Jones in our case, was not permissible on sales going outside the state. Now, counsel, I thought it was clear, but now I think it may be confused as to what I was trying to do about showing you that the same activities were used for nexus in two different taxpayers. We're using the actions of Ash and Jones, or at least the state of Washington is, to find nexus for Ash and Jones and to find nexus for Tyler Pipe. You've never done that before.
Well, what's the matter with that if someone is an agent for a principal? Couldn't a state levy a tax both on the agent for the activities as agent and on the principal by reason of the activities of the agent?
I think not. It's never been done before. And in this instance, you're using the same acts to establish presence for two different people.
Well, but if certainly the agent is obviously present in the state of Washington and is for its own activities, and if it's in fact the agent of your client, I just don't see what in our cases prevents that.
Well, it is there for its own activities, but its own activities are Tyler Pipe's activities. In fact, the state may be using nexus for eight different taxes because there are six or seven other manufacturers for whom Ash and Jones also
serves. Well, that doesn't strike me as contrary to any principles of agency law I ever knew about.
No, it's not a contrary to agency law. I say it's contrary to nexus law.
Well, but why should nexus law be any different than agency law in this respect? When you're trying to see whether your company had a presence within the state, you can certainly have a presence within the state through agents, can't you?
Yes, you can have presence. We are not suggesting that independent contractor establish some kind of wall. Yes, I do not say that. But you should not be able to count them twice. That's all I'm saying. And this court has never before done that. The counsel also says that lines up two or three items that counsel says Ash and Jones did for Tyler Pipe in the state of Washington. I refer you to pages 2 to 4 of Tyler Pipe's reply brief, where I have listed the activities that were done by Ash and Jones in Washington and the activities that occurred outside the state. That list is there for two or three reasons. One, to show that what Ash and Jones is doing is nothing more than selling. They can call it selling or marketing or whatever else. They are solicitors. They are sellers, and that's all they do. They can use all the facts they want to describe that, but it still comes out selling. I could probably spend 10 minutes this afternoon telling you how I shaved this morning and with all the details, but it's still just shaving, and that's all that Ash and Jones was doing, selling. We operated, Tyler Pipe operated through catalogs. It was a catalog operation in the state of Washington. The list is also there because I think it demonstrates that the tax is improperly apportioned as to the wholesaling activity. The most of these activities were outside the state, and therefore the state of Washington taxes the sales in Washington 100% without giving any credit for activities outside the state. In the Standard Prestige case, the court was very careful to point out that all of the activities occurred within the state. It is also there to demonstrate that there are, well, that isn't demonstrate, but in addition, the fact that the state of Washington provides no services to the Tyler Pipe is indicative of the fact that Tyler Pipe has no nexus in Washington. Now, I did say as to Tyler Pipe that Tyler Pipe did not pay a tax on its gross receipts outside the state of Washington. The 71 other taxpayers before you, I believe it is stipulated that they did do manufacturing outside the state, or they were taxed on gross receipts or other activities outside the state. I think that's a stipulated record. One reason the records may be a little different is that Tyler Pipe tried its case before the Armco case, and the 71 other cases were stipulated following the Armco decision. Tyler Pipe believes that it does not have nexus not only because of the double counting. That's just one incident. There are many other reasons. There's your case of Norton. The Norton case is right on point. In Norton, Norton had a manufacturing facility in the state of Massachusetts near Worcester. It was selling into the state of Indiana. Norton had a store, an actual store with inventory. The customers came to the store and bought inventory. If some of the items were not there, the customer would then order them. Some of the customers ordered directly from the manufacturer in Massachusetts. The court held that all shipments directly from the state of Massachusetts to the customer in Indiana were not subject to the gross receipts tax in Indiana because there was no nexus as to those sales. All of Tyler Pipe's products were shipped directly from Tyler Pipe to the customer. Ash and Jones never saw a piece of pipe. They were loaded on an interstate truck in Tyler, Texas, and were shipped at the risk of the buyer. Therefore, the Tyler Pipe has no connection with the state except for its solicitors. I don't think this court has found or held to date that solicitation alone does justify establishing nexus. If it has held that, then there's very little left to nexus. But I do not think there are any cases that hold that. As far as the 71 other cases are concerned, in those cases, there was either manufacturing in the state and wholesaling outside, or manufacturing outside the state and wholesaling within.
Mr. O'Brien, your time has expired.
Thank you, Chair.
The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.